The following program is made possible with a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and was first broadcast in 1984.
The world of Islam, the other face of Eve, women and family in Muslim societies. The program is introduced by ABC's Peter Jennings.
The status and role of women in Muslim society remains one of the most grossly misunderstood and misrepresented aspects of Islam. It is undoubtedly the source of much of the prejudice against Islam that is current in the non-Muslim West today. Most of us probably believe that Islam is inherently hostile to women. The Muslim woman is usually seen as the victim of a religion which maintains her in a state of ignorance, degrading segregation and sexual servitude. Only recently have we begun to realize that the position of women in Muslim societies may be far more complex and diverse than our conventional stereotypes. Are Muslim women really second-class citizens, prisoners of the veil, the harem, and ignorance? How much do Muslim women in, say, Indonesia or Pakistan have in common with their counterparts in West Africa, Egypt, or Saudi Arabia? What are the issues facing Muslim women today? And how relevant is Islam to their solution? The program is reported and narrated by Julian Crandall-Hollick.
And Islam says that the paradise is under the shoes of the mother. The paradise is under the shoes of the mother.
I feel that the status of women in Islam is very high and is certainly not what a lot of people in the West believe it to be.
I think that Islam truly does liberate a woman because it allows a woman to be professionally all that she can be.
To understand why so many Muslims believe that Islam is sympathetic to women, we have to go back to 7th century Arabia. Musrat Ali is a member of the All Pakistan Women's Association, now living in Islamabad.
In the social structure prevalent in Arabia, before the advent of Islam, women were treated like chattels. Polygamy was practiced to an unlimited extent. And a female infant was often buried alive on birth. This is what the status was before the advent of Islam. This inhuman practice was denounced and forbidden by the Prophet of Islam. It was when Islam came that these practices of believing a man to be superior to women were given up and forbidden.
Muhammad's message that men and women are equal was revolutionary for the times. But while men and women are equal in the eyes of God, they also have different rights and functions on earth. Asma Bakhmuz is a teacher in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia.
They are equal in one way. I mean, she has her own rights, he has his own rights. In front of that, she has certain duties toward him, he has certain duties to fulfill towards her. So they complete each other. But nobody is less or more.
But according to the Quran, men are in charge of women because they support the family. Alaya Shakur is a white American convert to Islam.
We all have the same position in front of God. We all have a spiritual equal position. Man has a little bit higher of a degree over us because of his physical abilities, as well as generally he has to be the provider for the family. But in every other way, woman is highly regarded.
In return for marital obedience, God gave woman certain well-defined rights. She was entitled to the same education as a man and encouraged to develop her talents to their limits, although the Quran did not encourage her to work outside the home. Women also had a clear legal status in Islamic law as persons entitled to inherit and manage property in their own right. When a woman got married, it could only be with her consent. She was entitled to nafaka, or maintenance, which could include her own house as well as modest allowances for housework, childcare, and clothing. The Muslim bride retained her maiden or family name after marriage and was entitled to draw up a marriage contract which could list possible grounds for divorce. Marriage was, and often still is, an economic and social contract between families, where a dowry or mahr is paid to the bride's family. In theory, this passed to the bride, giving her financial autonomy, but in practice, it led to frequent abuse by the bride's family.
Our religion tells us that the body of the woman should be covered, except for the face and the hands. I totally believe in this.
To most of us, the veil is probably synonymous with Islam. Yet there is considerable controversy, particularly in countries such as Indonesia, where veiling is almost totally absent, as to whether veiling is really Islamic. The Quran says, "Tell the believing women to gather their garments around them." Here, Laila Asawi, a young Egyptian schoolteacher, gives the orthodox interpretation.
This is part of the pride of the woman. Her body should not be public, should not be exposed for anyone to see. It should be her own and later for her husband, only for one man, not for public.
The custom of veiling seems to predate Islam and in fact is most probably of Persian and Jewish origin. Laila A. Ibrahim lives in Cairo, Egypt.
First of all, the Muslim women were not veiled, and they were not shut up in a harem. The veil and the system of harem existed a long time before Islam. But in Islam, in Medina, where Islam started, women were not veiled, and they were not shut up in the harem.
The origins of the practice of polygamy in Islam are also rather different from our popular Western stereotypes. Before Islam, men used to take as many wives as they desired. Muhammad placed strict limits on this licentious situation and limited the practice to a maximum of 4 wives. Khalija Saleh is a physicist and a Muslim activist living in the Malaysian capital of Kuala Lumpur.
It is in the Quran that says that marry 1, 2, 3, 4, but at the same time, there is a clause, the ayat, that states, if you cannot be just to all, be contented with one. A man had to be sure that he could be emotionally fair to all of them. Now, this is something which is just not possible. So it was really a negation of polygamy.
Islam differs in another way from Christianity and Judaism in its basic attitude towards woman. Islam does not see Eve as the seducer of Adam, responsible for man's fall from paradise and therefore the handmaiden of the devil. Man and woman are equally culpable. Suher Al-Kalamawi has been a feminist for over 40 years in Egypt and is now a member of that country's parliament.
We don't have this fallacy of having Eve in paradise cheating or doing Adam I don't know what, and she was the cause of his expel or exodus from the paradise. We don't have that in Islam at all. At all. They say the devil talked to both of them, and both of them were deceived by the devil, not by the woman.
Now, all of this was far from mere pious platitude on the part of Muhammad. Throughout his life, he displayed great compassion and friendship to women. Many of his ideas and attitudes presumably flowed from his first marriage to Khadija, the businesswoman who first hired him to work for her and then proposed marriage. Women were also extremely active in the early Muslim society, teaching in the mosque and fighting to defend the infant state. Another wife, the impetuous Aisha, in fact led an army into battle. When viewed in historical perspective against the practices of the then known world, Muhammad's feminism and the prescriptions of the Quran were indeed revolutionary. So how do we explain the blatant discrepancy between the progressive and detailed idealism of the Quran and Hadith with the second or third class status of women in so many Muslim societies? Why are 86% of all Muslim women illiterate? Why does polygamy still flourish in parts of Africa, Asia, and the Arab world? Why are women still physically segregated from men in certain Muslim societies and barred from taking an active intellectual, economic, or political role in so many Muslim countries? Khalija Saleh in Malaysia and Hassanah Tarabi, leader of the Muslim Brothers in the Sudan, agree on one principal cause.
Personally, I feel it is because the women were less educated. They did not know their rights. And therefore, they have a tendency to just believe what people say, what their rights are.
Conservative Islamic society has strayed away from Islam and under many influences has confined women to the home and deprived women of the right, I would say the religious obligation of enlightening themselves and sharing in the social life of society.
In most cases, the ideals of the Quran and Hadith were honored in the breach. Traditional custom and poverty were simply too powerful. In each case, pre-existing social and cultural mores helped shape the emerging Muslim society. For example, in pre-Islamic Arabia, men and women didn't mix outside the family circle. And in Saudi Arabia, this sexual segregation continues and is taken to perhaps unexpected limits. Women are not allowed to drive cars. Girls and boys are segregated throughout the educational system and in the working environment. And yet there are women entrepreneurs in Saudi Arabia, very much in the tradition of Khadija. Once again, Asma Bakhmuz in Jeddah.
For a woman to be a businesswoman, there is no objection, because she has the freedom to deal in business. And you will be surprised if you go to the Room of Commerce here and you'll see how many registration in names of women.
So you can have a women entrepreneur?
Yeah, no problem.
Abdullah Omar Nassif, Secretary General of the Muslim World League in Mecca, defends this segregation.
The mixing of the society is forbidden by religion. The mixing of the two sects unnecessarily in the streets, in offices, and this. And we have to obey. We cannot realize the wisdom until we really practice and we see the problems. But Allah has given us this order, and it is clearly there. We should obey it first, then we see what are the wisdom and what are the advantages and disadvantages of that society.
Islam says that the males and females are two species. They belong to the same human community, but their sphere of work is separate.
Mian Tufail is leader of the Jamaati Islami Party in Lahore, Pakistan. Tufail believes that women can only fully achieve their potential in a completely segregated society.
As a matter of fact, in a mixed society, they have no chance to advance and make progress as a competitors of male population. But if they are segregated from the males and left to compete amongst themselves, they can make maximum progress, maximum advancement in all spheres of life. They can become best doctors, best professors, best technicians, best engineers in their own lines.
I am a practicing Muslim. I have faith in God. I have faith in my religion. But I don't totally agree with the so-called Maulvis who just want to segregate the women in all respects. I don't agree with that.
Ritswana Jias is a mother and teacher living in the southern Pakistani city of Karachi.
Because the Islam that was revealed to us 1400 years ago was in a different society. And now we are living in a changing society, and as the world has changed, so the requirements and of the women have also changed.
And when the talk of Islamization began, so we thought that maybe some of the wrongs from which women have been suffering for so many years would be set right, and a new set of laws would come in, and some of the previous misconceptions would be done away with.
Rashida Patel is a lawyer and vice president of the powerful All Pakistan Women's Association. In Pakistan, it is still easier for a man to divorce a woman than vice versa. And in theory, the husband is supposed to provide for the wife and the children after divorce.
For instance, we do believe that maintenance for a divorced wife is decreed in the Holy Quran. But yet in the Pakistan law, for years, it is just accepted that a man and a woman after divorce are separate entities, and the woman has no right of maintenance after divorce.
In 1979, the government of President Zia-ul-Haq proposed a series of Islamization measures which attempted to reintroduce conservative interpretations of the Islamic law or Sharia into Pakistani society often to the anger of women. One of the most controversial measures, now law, is the so-called zina or fornication ordinance, which makes adultery a punishable crime. Rashida Patel is especially angry at the way the law has been carried out through a literalist interpretation of the Quran.
Well, unfortunately, we found that no positive thinking was done on these lines, which we were waiting for. Now what has happened is certain judges have taken the fact of having given birth to a child by an unmarried woman or a married woman who is away from her husband as ipso facto a proof of her having committed zina. So in those cases, a lot of public opinion was created, a lot of protests were made that this is not right for the women to suffer like this, because it's a crime which is committed by two people, and when you cannot convict two people, how can you convict one person?
The most visible symbols for Westerners of women's status in Muslim society are the veil and the chador, the long tent-like robe that seems almost synonymous with Islam. Here, paradoxes abound. In Egypt, for example, the veil is a status symbol worn only by the upper class.
I haven't seen a veil on my relatives in my village. But my mother, who was from a rich family, and her mother, I used to see them with a veil, and then they took off the veil. But my relatives, my aunts in the village, they never had it.
Nawal al-Sadawi is a doctor and writer now living in Cairo. Her father came from a small village in Upper Egypt, her mother from an affluent family in Cairo.
I am a Muslim woman, but I'm not veiled. That's the superficial way of having an identity. But veiling women and sexual segregation and all this nonsense, I think it's quite backward, and this does not help women. It really helps them backward, but not forward.
Well, I understand people who do it. They are trying to imitate the Prophet's wives because they think that those women are the example of all Muslim women and they should do the same. And I respect them for doing it, but I don't think it's a must for all Muslim girls, and I don't imagine myself doing it.
Maha Salah is a young Egyptian journalist and committed Muslim activist living in Cairo. In the past few years, many young Egyptian women have returned to wearing Islamic dress, or what they call Islamic dress. Some have gone back to the veil or niqab as a sign of their commitment to Islam. Maha Salah, however, rejects the view that its use is obligatory.
When you wear a niqab, you are just withdrawing from your society. And I'm not doing this, I don't want to do it. I mean, your face doesn't only show how beautiful you are or something, but it shows how you feel and how you look at things and what is your reactions to other people and what they say. But when I'm covering my face, it's as if I'm telling people that I'm not here anymore.
In Saudi Arabia, on the other hand, no woman jealous of her honor would be seen in the streets or outside the family home without the chador or the veil. To Asma Bakhmous, this anonymous garment is both familiar and comfortable.
I'm getting all my rights as a Muslim, and I'm really relaxed in dressing and everything. You know, it's much easier for me when I walk out just to wear this veil and walk out. I don't need to care very much for my appearance when I'm out. Inside my house, I have every freedom to wear anything I like, and you can think of. In my own house. So it's no problem.
In Pakistan, where Islamization has been official policy for several years now, civil servants are required to wear a headscarf in public. And in Lahore, the most conservative part of the country, it's still common to see women covered from head to toe in the chador, walking along dusty Multan Road. But unlike Egypt, educated women in Pakistan seem to be moving away from this dress code.
Well, even in Pakistan today, there are many homes where the old or the elderly head of the family makes an objection to the girls of the family going out without a burqa, without a parda or a veil. And the girls, if you ask them, they say, well, our grandfather does not seem to understand that we are going to study to be doctors. And we go and dissect bodies along with male patients, students and patients. And he insists that we wear a veil from the home up to the hospital. And so we do it because he happens to be our grandfather. But after he would die, they would not continue.
In Malaysia or Indonesia, it's almost as rare to see a woman veiled as it would be in rural America. Najib Al-Attas is an Islamic activist living in Petaling Jaya, a suburb of the Malaysian capital, Kuala Lumpur.
But here, Muslim women, for example, they don't wear veils. They work with their husbands in the field, and the one who work in the office, they don't wear veil. This is already a normal way here.
In Malaysia, the Islamic resurgence has been accompanied by a certain puritanism, especially in sexual matters. For example, there is legislation making extramarital sex between Muslims a crime. Yet in general, Malays are less overtly aggressive in their Islamic zeal, and Khalija Saleh emphatically rejects the idea of segregation.
I don't understand why we should live in segregation. Why can't we get to know the other sex? I mean, instead of just getting to know your father, your brothers, the immediate kins, why can't you get to know other people? After all, you know, there's a lot more to share. If we can communicate, we can learn about one another, our life will be very much enriched.
In Indonesia, the most populous Muslim state, women enjoy considerable equality of opportunity, perhaps because parts of the Indonesian archipelago were once matrilineal societies. Dawan Rahadjo is editor of the Indonesian weekly Tempo.
We are not Arabs. We are not Pakistan. We are Indonesian. And we think that Quran said that woman, man and woman are equal. They are partners. This is the basic principle, and we have to make this realize. And for instance, they would like to wear the veil, you know. This is Arabian or Iranian, I don't care. I mean, if they want that kind of clothing, this is up to them, but not us, Indonesian. Why should we?
I never met a peasant woman in Morocco who wants to put the veil on. The veil doesn't exist. It's not a poor woman's phenomena. It's a rich woman's phenomena.
Fatima Manisi is a Moroccan feminist living in Casablanca. Manisi believes the real issue facing Muslim women is not dress at all.
They want to get rid of the veil and to get access to the streets and to jobs and to work. And their big frustration in life is not the veil. Their big frustration is that they are illiterate. They cannot have access to modernity, to modern jobs, and to new skills, and new training. And that's their big problem in their life.
The practice of polygamy survives in all Muslim countries except Tunisia, South Yemen, Soviet Central Asia, Turkey, and Lebanon, where it has been banned. In Egypt and Indonesia, recent family legislation has placed strict conditions on its practice. Similarly, in Pakistan, the 1961 Family Laws Ordinance brought an end to the shameful but widespread practice where men verbally divorced wives at will in order to make way for a fresh wife. Now the first wife must give her consent before a judge. But in the West African state of the Gambia, almost half of all marriages are still polygamous. Fatou Sese is head of the Gambia's Family Planning Service. As her work meant frequent absences away from home, her husband was pressured by his family to take a second wife. One day, Fatou Sese returned from work to find her husband had finally given in.
So when I came, he brought in this to say, well, I'm very sorry to tell you, Fatou, but now I've been cornered and a second one has to come. I said, is that so? He said, I said, okay, since it will not interfere with my work, I don't mind. So he said, I don't like it, but then I say, whenever you mind, I don't mind. Because it's just nonsense for me to say, no, I don't like it, you know. When the whole setting, the tradition, customs and everything advocate for it, and we sit in the corner to say, no, we want to be Western, we want to be... It cannot work. So I had to give in. Although, honestly, I don't like it, but what have I got to do? It is a difficult experience because you find that things that you used to do alone with your husband, you can no longer do again, or probably what you were entitled to with your family, now it has to be divided, you know, the love, the care, the interest, everything. but I still believe that love cannot be divided.
Both Laila Asawi in Cairo and Asma Bahmuz in Jeddah would be prepared under certain circumstances to allow their husbands to take a second wife.
I think it's better to have a second wife than having a mistress. So it's a way of legalizing the relation between man and woman.
I accept as a Muslim, I accept all what God decides for me and my husband, for my life. And under certain conditions, for example, I fail to give him children. And he really would love to have a child. I think if I love my husband, I would let him marry.
You would?
Yeah. If I fail to give him children, yes. Why not?
The Quran and Hadith were revolutionary in their attitudes to women in 7th century Arabia. But how relevant are they today? And to what degree is the message still revolutionary? Rashida Patel in Karachi feels Islam still has an important role to play in furthering women's rights.
Islam is a force in Pakistan. You cannot deny it. You cannot walk away from Islam. We need Islam. We are Muslims. We are not prepared to walk away from Islam. But we also need to reinterpret Islam as such. And if you tell a woman that, well, this is your Islamic right, it is easier to convince her.
Fatima Manisi in Casablanca feels that the current emphasis on family law completely misses the point.
The Moroccan law talks and regulates sexuality as if that's the only problem of the family. The Muslim family, as it is now, the problem, maybe there is sexual problem, but they are minor compared to economic problems. The economic problems are the major problems of the family, and the major problem of the Moroccan woman now is unemployment.
Well, you see, your society or American society is very different from our society. Our religion, our culture, our cultural background, our heritages, they don't permit so much permissiveness as is visible in your society. And I don't agree with what is present in your society, because liberality does not mean that you can just, go out and be all on your own. There are definite and certain checks on us, because now, even if my husband is away, I know what is wrong and what is right for me, what he'll like or what he'll not like. So I'm not a totally repressed woman, but I know my limits. And I think I'm very happy in those limits.
The Other Face of Eve was written and produced by Julian Crandall-Hollick. The program was introduced by ABC's Peter Jennings. The technical producer was Peter K. Storkerson, and the rebroadcast producer was Dean Capello. The music consultant was Brian Silver of International Music Associates. Consultant to this program was Elizabeth Warnock Furnia of the University of Texas at Austin. The World of Islam is a production of IBA, Independent Broadcasting Associates, in cooperation with WBUR Boston, and is made possible with a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm Mark Schilling. If you'd like to comment on this program or to order cassette copies and transcripts, please phone area code 508-486-9180 or fax number 508-486-9652 during regular business hours. This is NPR, National Public Radio.